You're listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. So tonight we get to watch Alex Ross on the high wire, finding common ground among 16th century Spanish musicians, Johannes Bach, Ellington's 40s band, Led Zeppelin's bassist. He follows the ostinato, the bass line, from the late Renaissance to the Delta blues. As many of you know, I'm sure many of you here are New Yorker readers. Alex has been the music critic for The New Yorker since 1996. Before that, he wrote for The New York Times, and his first book, The Rest is Noise, and we were very lucky to hear him talk about that, to listen to the 20th century. Last time he was here at Aloud, won the 2007 National Books Critics Circle Award and was a finalist for the 2008 Pulitzer Prize. And in 2008, Alex was named a MacArthur Fellow. I know that after tonight, you'll be augmenting your iTunes libraries and listening to all kinds of music you may not have known about before. I recently had the pleasure of spending a few days with an ornithologist, after which it's like I remember to look up, you know, and to notice the birds in my garden in a different way. And I know that after tonight, after you spend time with Alex, you'll be listening to the blues, to Bjork and Bach in a new way. You'll be able to listen more closely. It's Alex's great gift. Please welcome Alex Ross. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Louise, for that lovely introduction. And it is very nice to be back here at the library as part of the Aloud series. I was here in the fall of 2007, which somehow feels like ancient history now that the world changes so quickly. Twitter didn't exist, or at least was very young at that point, and so many the landscape is always rapidly changing. But of course, libraries remain, and books still count, and I'm very happy to be part of this operation. I also just wanted to mention backstage, I was thinking about Alan Rich, the longtime music critic of the LA Weekly, and before that, New York Magazine, and other publications. Alan dropped by beforehand when I gave my talk 3 years ago, and I remember chatting with him, and I miss him very much, so I would like to dedicate this to Alan in a way, and I hope he is long remembered. The title of the talk is Chacona, Lamento Walking Blues, Bass Lines of Music History. It's based on the second chapter of my new book, Listen to This, in which I really try to take the widest possible view of the contemporary musical world, looking for continuities and hidden links. Today, in about an hour, I am going to try to go through really most of music history, and there's a lot of ground to cover, so I will jump right in with the dance known as the Chacona. If you want to get up and dance, feel free to do so. One evening in the month of roses, a dancing party was held. It gave a thousand pleasures, its fame went far and wide. To life, to the good life, la vida bona, Let's All Go to Chacona. This is Un Sarao de la Chacona, a song published in 1624 by the Spanish musician Juan Arañez. It tells of various scandalous shenanigans at the wedding of Almadan. A blind man pokes girls with a stick. An African heathen sings with a gypsy. A doctor wears pans around his neck for some reason. Drunks, thieves, cuckolds, brawlers, and men and women of ill repute complete the scene. The Chacona became very popular at the beginning of the 17th century, too popular for the Spanish King's Council, which banned it from public theaters. Its lyrics tended to be bawdy, sexually suggestive, with a hint of subversion in its picture of topsy-turvy goings-on. One question I want to ask tonight is, how do you get from that to this? Bach's Chacona in D minor, of course, from the second partita for solo violin. These two pieces, both called Chacona, seem to have nothing in common beyond the fact that they are in triple meter with an emphasis on the second beat. It's a case of total musical transformation across a relatively short span of time, 1624 to 1720. Like a cityscape, music is always furiously changing, often beyond recognition. Yet, you can also find features of the landscape that have changed surprisingly little. In the following two excerpts, we'll make a jump of more than 300 years, yet the bass remains the same. Monteverdi's Lamento della Ninfa, The Lament of the Nymph, and of course, Ray Charles. These four notes have been sounding through music for hundreds of years. They can mean many different things, but they often seem associated with feelings of sorrow, especially when they move slowly in even values. I want to begin tonight with this little signal of lament. It seems to take off from a physical fact. A crying, sobbing, or sighing person emits sounds that slide gradually downward in pitch, then return to a higher pitch to begin the slide again. The same contour can be found in laments around the world. It seems to evoke not only the sounds that we make when in distress, but also the inward state of our minds and bodies. The depressed person feels literally pulled downward. The face, shoulders, and arms droop in sympathy. It also metaphorically suggests a descent to the grave or the netherworld. But there's also something cathartic about letting out these sounds, releasing them into the world. We always feel better after we cry. It's a very basic, primitive, mammalian thing to do. Animals make very similar sounds. That was Malina making her Los Angeles debut. Listening to folk music recordings, especially from Eastern Europe, you hear that four-note falling pattern often in songs of sorrow. Here's a recording of a Romanian bocet, or lament. Draga! Maica mele, ai maica mele, maica In a Hungarian village, a woman uses a similar figure to sing, "Oh, woe is me, what have I done against the great Lord that he has taken my beloved spouse away?" Now listen to the sigiriya form of flamenco. I always find you weeping in the corners. That's the flamenco master Manuel Torres, recorded in 1922. From the fact that many funeral songs go downward in pitch, it does not follow that every descending melody has lamentation on its mind. You can find plentiful counterexamples. I list some in my book. The pattern is not a universal signifier of lament, and I'm not sure that any figures in music carry intrinsic meaning. But the motif does seem to have acquired definite and recurring associations in multiple traditions. It has a tendency toward lament. Now let's turn to notated music of the Renaissance period. Around 1460, the Franco-Flemish composer Johannes Ockeghem, who created polyphonic works of dazzling and dizzying complexity, wrote a chanson entitled Four Saulmons. The text begins with the lines, "Save only for the expectation of death, no hope dwells in my weary heart." The opening notes, setting the words Four Saulmons, trace out what I'm going to call the classic form of lament, that four-note falling folkish motif. By the middle of the 16th century, scholars were beginning to evolve a rough musical vocabulary of lament. In 1558, Josefo Zarlino instructed composers to use cheerful harmonies and fast rhythms for cheerful subjects, and sad harmonies and grave rhythms for sad subjects. When a composer wishes to express effects of grief and sorrow, he should, observing the rules given, use movements which proceed through the semitone, reference to the chromatic scale. And for those who don't know, this is simply the scale that moves up or down by half steps. Think of consecutive notes on the piano keyboard, both black and white. I'll be referring to this many times as we go forward. It seems an intensification of this musical gesture of lament. With the smaller subdivisions, it takes us closer to the primal sliding sound of the cry or the sob. A grieving stepwise descent became commonplace in Italian madrigals of the later 16th century, including some famously intricate examples by Carlo Gesualdo, the homicidal prince of Venosa. It's also a feature of music of the Elizabethan period in England, where there was a great deal of flamboyant brooding in the Hamlet style. The supreme melancholic among English composers was the brilliant songwriter and lutenist John Dowland, who, for better or worse, has had a popular resurgence in recent years thanks to the efforts of Sting. In a solo lute piece entitled Forlorn Hope Fancy, Doland made obsessive use of a descending chromatic gesture. Yet Doland also had a flair for hummable melody. Another lute piece entitled Lacrimae, Tears, became immensely popular across Europe in the last years of the 16th century, inspiring dozens of takeoffs. When Doland published his second book of songs in 1600, he included a vocal version of his Lacrimae air with words that Hamlet might comfortably have spoken. Flow my tears, fall from your springs, exiled forever let me mourn, where night's black bird her sad infamy sings, there let me live forlorn. Philip K. Dick later borrowed the title for one of his most famous novels, Flow My Tears, the Policeman Said. Again, those four falling notes of lament. That's Andreas Scholl singing, by the way. Just at the time when Doland was most active as a composer, the chaconne came into view. The dance was first cited by name in 1598 in Peru, although it may well have been much older. By 1606, the chaconne was appearing in manuals for amateur guitarists. The written versions are essentially formulaic chord progressions over which the player is encouraged to improvise variations. The first composer to begin to do something with the form, develop it in some way, was Girolamo Frescobaldi, whose Partite sopra Chaconne, or Variations on the Chaconne, was published in 1627. Frescobaldi also wrote variations on a related dance form, the Passacaglia. Frescobaldi's partite are sophisticated, fantastically inventive, almost avant-garde. They subject the formulas to constant elaboration, with the bass line changing, the meter changing, even the key changing in later examples. So you hear those interesting harmonic twinges, these momentary darkenings of mood, which forecast, in a way, the chaconne in D minor of Bach and other chaconnes to come. Monteverdi, the leading Italian composer of the day, also joined in the chaconne fad. In 1632, he published the duet Zefiro Torna, an exuberant springtime song. And the important feature here is the bass line, which repeats and repeats, creating here a buoyant mood. But a few years later, Monteverdi published his Lamento della Ninfa, which we heard earlier next to Ray Charles, and there the hypnotically repeating bass line acquires tragic import. The disconsolate nymph of the title sings, "Let my lover become again what he once was, or else kill me so that I torment myself no more." The vocal line moves laboriously upward, step by step. The bass line moves steadily down in the now familiar four-note pattern. Bernarda Fink singing. The repetition of the dance has been fused with the lament figure, creating a sensuous, mesmerizing melancholy, pain and pleasure mixed. The music mimics beautifully the obsessive habits of the lovelorn mind. The musical term for such unvarying repetition is ostinato, from the Italian word for obstinate. That lamenting bass line was taken up by Monteverdi's younger colleague Francesco Cavalli, whose name is now known mostly to enthusiasts of Baroque opera, but who was among the most successful and widely performed composers of his time. Cavalli came up with an important innovation. He added two notes to the repeating pattern so that it became chromatic. The reason you hear birds twittering in the background of these examples, by the way, is that I recorded them last summer in Marlborough, Vermont, on one of Mitsuko Uchida's beautiful pianos there. This chromatic Cavalli variation, as I could call it, happens in the pivotal opera La Didone, telling of Dido, queen of Carthage, who falls in love with the Trojan Aeneas and then kills herself when the gods summon Aeneas away to found Rome. But the first act is set in Troy. We hear, among others, Hecuba, widow of King Priam, lamenting the death and destruction all around her. Opera was relatively new at this time, less than 50 years old. Cavalli helped establish many of its characteristics. Above all, he was known for these moments in which characters step forward and unleash a storm of emotion. We're seeing the emergence of the aria, the great diva or divo display. The ostinato proved to be a crucial device. The emotion keeps getting heightened in the voice as the steady repetition continues. Let's listen to a later part of Hecuba's lament, in which she takes on a prophetic, apocalyptic tone, as if not only remembering the fall of Troy, but foreseeing the demise of regimes to come. Porticos, temples are shaking and trembling, burning and tumbling. Purple and empire turn into dust, make clothes of ashes. And again, listen for the bass line crawling underneath. That's Marie-Claire Lemieux singing. Operatic prophecies of doom were not so common in later 17th century France, where Louis XIV appropriated opera as a mirror image of his worldly power. Jean-Baptiste Lully, the Florence-born musician who went on to become the supreme musical figure at the court of Louis XIV, very often installed grand chaconnes at the ends of his operas and ballets, using them to show the reconciliation of warring forces and the restoration of happiness, symbolizing, supposedly, the radiance of the Sun King's rule. Yet the chaconne had not altogether lost its exotic association. It was defined in 1690 as a dance which came from the Moors. As scholars have observed, Lully connected his chaconnes to the representation of Italian, Spanish, North African, even Chinese characters and locales. The Ballet d'Alcidion et Polyxandre from 1658 contains a chaconne des Moors, chaconne of the Moors, accompanying the entry of Moorish slaves playing the guitar. Amazingly enough, Louis XIV himself appeared as one of the dancing Moors, wearing a black mask. English composers of the later 1600s remained entranced by the lamenting properties of the descending chromatic line, which Doland had helped to introduce some decades before. Mr. Henry Purcell often reached for the downward trudging figure to convey the blacker end of the emotional spectrum, as in plunged in the confines of despair. Or, "Oh, I'm sick of life." Sometimes you just wake up feeling that way. But Purcell's greatest lament is given to the long-suffering Dido. He takes up the Venetian opera device of the chromatic ground bass, which Cavalli introduced in his Dido opera, and uses it to even more heart-stopping effect. He takes care first to introduce the bass line on its own, so there's no mistaking its operation. It is like a grand, chilly staircase appearing before one's feet. Here is the great Lorraine Hunt Lieberson singing with the Philharmonia Baroque. going to return to this extraordinary music and recording at the very end. By the early 18th century, the old Chacona was more than a century old, and it was fading from view in many European countries. It persisted, though, in instrumental music, especially in Germany, where it took on an increasingly somber character. Johann Pachelbel is famous or infamous for his Canon in D, which has a certain chaconne-like swing, but the finale of his prelude, fugue, and chaconne for organ is actually somewhat frightening. We are obviously very close now to the world of Bach. His Chacona for solo violin is so aggressively devoid of La Vita Buona that the title seems almost perverse. The two main forms of musical lament, the four-note descent and the chromatic version, are heard throughout, woven into the texture in various ways. The chromatic kind stabs at the ear in variation 5. The Chacona contains an extended major key episode that functions as a kind of respite from the reigning darkness of the piece. But when we hear a descending chromatic line high in the treble, we may sense that these happy days are numbered. Shortly after, D minor does return over a classic four-note lamento. This is Gidon Kremer playing from his great ECM recording of the complete Sonatas and Partitas. The peculiar anguish of this music comes from the fact that all of the contrapuntal conflict is taking place on a single instrument, metaphorically within a single soul. The scholar Susan McClary says that in this piece, the lone violinist must both furnish the redundant ostinato and also fight tooth and nail against it. She says that the pleasurable repetitions of the chaconne have become a nightmare from which the individual self is struggling in vain to escape. Yet, as Alexander Silberger points out in another essay, traces do remain of the original chaconne. Whether or not Bach was aware of the ancestry of the form, Silberger notes improvisatory-sounding passages where an upper voice stalls in a single pitch while the fundamental pattern repeats, and also instances of repeated strumming, rustling arpeggiations, and sudden foot stamping. Often Bach stretches the boundaries of his variation scheme and lands back in the home D minor with a precarious swing. Silberger goes on to say that these tricks and devices also recall the practices of masters of improvisation, whether the Renaissance lute and gamba virtuosos, or, for that matter, today's great jazz artists and sitar and tabla players. It's interesting how different, and yet how natural, the chaconne sounds when it is played on the guitar, here in the hands of Andres Segovia. Perhaps we have not come as far from the original Chacona as we may think. We're certainly not worlds away from flamenco in its most tragic form. At the end of his life, Bach assembled his Mass in B minor, rearranging extant works from his catalog and writing some new music to complete the towering conception of the piece. In the Crucifixus, representing the death of Jesus Christ on the cross, Bach turned, inevitably perhaps, to the crawling lamento bass. We feel again the individual straining against the ostinato of fate. The bass line is repeated 13 times. The voices push against its implacable descent, moving in various directions. There are slowly pulsing chords of strings on the first and third beats, flutes on the second and third. They suggest something dripping, perhaps blood from Christ's wounds or tears from the eyes of his followers. In the 13th iteration, the bass singers give up their contrary motion and join the downward march of the continuo section. The sopranos, too, take a chromatic path. The upper instruments drop out, a dramatic effect suggesting that the dripping has stopped and that life is spent. The victory of the bass line seems complete. But then it suddenly reverses direction, and there is a momentous last-minute swerve from E minor into the key of G major. On the next page, the resurrection begins. Here, without commercial interruption, is the Crucifixus from the Mass in B minor, performed by the Collegium Vocale Ghent under the direction of Philippe Herrevega. In the later 18th century, forms based on strict repetition, such as the chaconne, the passacaglia, and the lamento aria, became scarce. Music was becoming more linear, more narrative. From Haydn and Mozart onward, composers prized constant development, and restless changes of key made it unlikely that a given piece or movement would be tied together with a recurring pattern. The lamento became a somewhat antique device, even a cliché. Already in Mozart, it seems to have an archaic air. He was familiar with the device from an early age, the descending chromatic figure, and I do mean early, the age of 9. The telltale descent appears in many of the sacred works that Mozart was required to churn out during his youth in Salzburg. Later, it seems to serve as a signifier of ancient, uncanny, solemn forces. At the beginning of Don Giovanni in the overture, a forbidding chromatic descent anticipates the entrance of the stone statue of the Commendatore. Beethoven, at the end of the tragic-minded first movement of his Ninth Symphony, employs a chromatic ostinato to create a kind of official funerary atmosphere, and we know from his letters that the bass line of Bach's Crucifixus interested him. Franz Schubert wrote ostensibly happy music that was tinged with sadness, and sad music which managed to be profoundly consoling. In his final string quartet, the quartet in G, he inserted a falling chromatic pattern into major key music, using it to force a series of sudden harmonic shifts that have an almost subliminally disturbing effect. A very Schubertian effect, a shadow falling over major key music. Tchaikovsky's Pathetique Symphony is unambiguously a symphony of fate and death. And in the finale, marked Adagio Lamentoso, we should not be surprised to find lamento lines everywhere. The classic four summons form, Akagem again, is combined with the chromatic lamento. At the end of the 19th century, a growing interest in the pre-Romantic past, this was the time when everyone was trying to overcome the influence of Richard Wagner, led to a revival of Renaissance and Baroque forms and techniques. Johannes Brahms, the reigning classicist in German music, capped his final symphony, the Fourth, with an archaic-sounding, though immensely forceful finale that seems to draw on dark old chaconnes by Buxtehude and Bach. Here we have the sense, I think, that music is again rotating in place as opposed to racing from point A to point B. In the 20th century, the chaconne and the passacaglia, its sibling form, unexpectedly returned to fashion as composers looked to the distant past for clues to the chaotic present. Alban Berg inserted a passacaglia in his opera Wozzeck, a tale of the endless madness of military life. Both Benjamin Britten and Dmitri Shostakovich used the recurring bass lines of the passacaglia to suggest the inescapable tensions of modern existence. In the late 20th century, the great Hungarian composer Georges Ligeti showed a particular fascination with this material. In 1993, I heard Ligeti give a talk at the New England Conservatory in which he gave a whirlwind history of chaconne, passacaglia, and lament. That lecture, to a great extent, inspired this one and the corresponding essay in my book. I'll play a brief excerpt from the lecture, kindly supplied by the New England Conservatory, followed by a reprise of the Boccette and a passage from the powerful Lamento from Ligeti's 1982 horn trio.
I was very much impressed by this Romanian lamentos, which old women sing who are paid for when somebody is dead in a village. And maybe this is some musical signal which is very, very deep in my subconscious. I speak about it, but it was not conscious. And then my predilection, my personal love for the passacaglia form in connection with the Dido and Aeneas lamento, and in connection with the Romanian folk music, this led me to use in a lot of my pieces this passacaglia chromatic.
Draga meli maica mele, ai maica meli maica mele, to me maica cu caro, to me.
Thank you.
Finally, let's talk about the blues. Coincidentally or not, you find a falling chromatic figure, not quite the same as the one we've been hearing tonight, but similar in profile, all over the blues and so much of the popular music that followed. It's particularly pronounced in the blues of the Mississippi Delta, where you find an emphatically repeating line plucked out on the guitar, as in Willie Brown's Future Blues.
Can't tell my future, I can't tell my past. Lord, it seems like
or Skip James, Devil Got My Woman. Robert Johnson, Walkin' Blues.
I woke up this morning, year round for my shoes. Her bag got this, whoa, walkin' blues. Woke up this morning, year round.
Of course, this music has very different musical roots, but you still feel the age-old emotional downward pull of that series of notes. Of course, this being the blues, it won't do to describe the songs simply as laments. There is sensualism here and toughness, a sense of resilience, resistance, so that the tinge of sadness seems to reverse itself and in some way create its opposite. As Wynton Marsalis says, blues are an inoculation. You give yourself a little to keep the real blues away. Traces of lament also appear in Tin Pan Alley music back in the period of the 20s, 30s, and 40s. George Gershwin loved to introduce slinky chromatic patterns in the inner voices of songs like Someone to Watch Over Me. Frank Sinatra, who was such a great interpreter of this repertory, I think was especially attracted to songs with that hint of chromaticism in them. Here he is singing Angel Eyes.
Pardon me, but I gotta run. The facts uncommonly clear. I gotta find who's now the number one and why my angel eyes ain't here. Excuse me while I disappear.
That last bit wasn't strictly relevant, but there's no fading down Frank early. The incomparable Nelson Riddle arrangement, of course. In the 1960s, for reasons that are hard to pin down, but that may have to do with the revival that took place a few years earlier of interest in Baroque music, Glenn Gould recording the Goldberg variations and so on, very strict Baroque-style descending chromatic basses appear all over pop music. And I'm now going to play a somewhat zany montage of songs from the 60s and 70s.
Thank you.
chimney, chim, chimney, chim, chim, cheree. A sweep is as lucky can be. Chim, chimney, chim, chimney, chim, chim, cheroo. Good luck will rub off when I shake hands with you. Or blow me a kiss. And that's lucky too.
Together again for the first time, Chim Chim Cheree from Mary Poppins, The Beatles, Michelle, The Eagles, Hotel California, and Bob Dylan, Ballad of a Thin Man, live in Manchester in 1966. More to the point, I will also play Nina Simone's 1965 recording of the great anti-lynching song, Strange Fruit. Simone, a classically trained pianist with a deep love of Bach, rewrote the accompaniment to feature a four-note lamento in the ancient style.
Southern trees barren strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the roots. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Somehow, centuries after the lamenting bass surfaced, its meaning often remained the same. It summons up the texture of depression and despair, the heart descending step by step to the bottom and going back up to repeat the journey. It retains its cathartic effect so that dark regions are filled with mysterious light. Such figures reveal the interconnectedness of musical experience. If you could bring together some late 16th century Spanish musicians, a continuous section led by Bach, and players from Duke Ellington's 1929 band, perhaps, and then ask John Paul Jones to start them off with the bass line of Led Zeppelin's Dazed and Confused, they might, after a minute or two of confusion, find common ground.
Thank you.
That's just the beginning of a massive 25-minute version of the song live at the LA Forum in 1972, and it plays like a massive variation sequence, partite, on that descending chromatic figure. And in Bob Dylan's 1975 song, Simple Twist of Fate, you can find an eerie correspondence with an earlier lament. Here is the story of a man who has a brief affair with a woman, and when she walks away, he finds himself haunted by her, much as he tries to forget her. It's in a major key, but it's anchored on that old descending chromatic bass, and thus enters into the same ambiguous sphere as, say, Schubert's Quartet in G. As in Dido's Lament by Purcell, the bass line is laid out first in the instruments before the singer begins. And as in Purcell, the word fate plays a prominent role. Indeed, the idea of forgetting fate. This bass line seems to have fate built into it. But an interesting reversal has happened across the centuries. In Purcell's Dido, it is the man who is summoned away, leaving the woman bereft. In Dylan's smaller-scale tragedy, it is the woman who forgets and the man who is left to contemplate the twisting and turning of fate.
A saxophone someplace far off played as she was walking on by the arcade, as the light bust through a beat-up shade where he was waking up. She dropped a coin into the cup above a blind man at the gate and forgot about a simple twist of fate.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you so much. If people want to ask questions, we have a microphone ready to, two microphones on either side. Yes. Or you could call Louise. Yes, right here.
Don't these progressions elicit a basic psychophysiological response, such that composers and performers will naturally gravitate and inevitably come to these forms because they are so powerfully evocative?
I think so. I mean, that's sort of the idea underlying this entire presentation, is that, you know, whether a composer or a musician in one particular place or time is aware of the associations that have built up around this kind of figure or not, they do tend to gravitate toward it. I think there is a definite conscious tradition that did become attached to the figure. And as I said, it's spelled out in some of the theoretical literature in the 16th century. And, you know, by the time Beethoven uses that figure in his Ninth Symphony, he's almost certainly making a reference to Bach, making a reference to this lament tradition. But then, you know, in other places, the Mississippi Delta blues singers probably weren't thinking of that that classical Western tradition, although Skip James was a very musically smart guy, and we just can't be sure about that. But exactly as you say, if you're going to represent sadness with music, you naturally reach for these falling figures. And as I noted, you see it in folk traditions all over the place, and those traditions presumably weren't communicating directly with each other. So that's a very nice way to put it. Over here?
I thought one of the things implied in your talk was that we can skip from Baroque to classical to Led Zeppelin without really skipping a beat today. Whereas a generation ago, in my experience anyway, that wasn't true. Classical fans like classical, pop like pop. Now I've even heard friends complaining that there are such things as classical music stations and that there should just be good music stations that play whatever. Do you think this is true, and what's going on, and where's it headed?
Well, it's a very nice idea, actually, the the good music station that pays no attention to genre. I think actually, you know, a lot of college stations follow that rule, although maybe we can have a debate about what's good or not, and taste enters into it, of course. But yes, I mean, I think maybe there's been some evolution in this regard. Certainly, you know, this is another underlying thesis or idea of this lecture, the chapter in my book, and really the entire book, the work that I've done in The New Yorker over the years, is to jump some of these barriers which seem so imposing between genres, you know, while respecting each genre. I'm not one of these people who thinks that music should just kind of be smeared together into some kind of mush where you can no longer make such distinctions, because I think musicians, creative musicians, very often need genre. They need a discipline and a tradition to work against, define themselves against. So genres remain very important. But certainly there's no reason why we as listeners can't make these jumps. And you know, so many people I know listen to more than one kind of music. And I think, you know, I grew up with classical music, and it was such a great moment for me in college when I finally very belatedly made the leap into rock and jazz and other kinds of music. It just opened up my whole world in so many ways. So I'm always kind of urging people to make that leap, including the leap into classical music, which seems so forbidding to a lot of people. If I didn't study it, if I didn't grow up with it, then I'll never get it. But it's actually based on some very simple and enduring principles, as I've been pointing out tonight. And there is so much common ground with the music that everyone knows and did grow up with. Yes, right here.
Actually, this is a little bit off what you were talking about tonight, but in your last few decades or so as a critic and attending a lot of symphonic concerts, have there been any pieces that you think might conceivably lodge themselves into the standard repertoire? Do you think the idea of a standard repertoire is a time that has passed or anything like that? But are there any pieces that struck you as possibly making their way?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's hazardous to make such predictions because, you know, the audiences of the future can have a very different taste from the audiences of today. I mean, if you look at what was actually being played in Vienna in Beethoven's time, or earlier in Mozart's time, or you know, toward the end of the 19th century. I mean, there's a great deal of music by composers we've never heard of, who apparently had a following and were even very popular, and who have totally dropped from sight. You know, I always think of George Bernard Shaw, among other things, one of the greatest classical music critics, who was always campaigning for Hermann Götz. And he thought that Hermann Götz had a surefire chance to be remembered across the centuries, and that turned out not to be true. But I don't doubt Shaw's passion for this music, and I go and listen to it sometimes and sort of try to hear what it was that got him so excited, and I just haven't found it yet. And, you know, maybe, you know, the composers that I write about with similar passion, if not quite the same style, perhaps they will be remembered 50 years from now, perhaps not. I mean, I would certainly vote for John Adams' Harmony Lehre or Naiven Sentimental Music, which had its premiere at the LA Philharmonic, of course, or Thomas Addis's Asyla comes to mind, contemporary operas such as Kaija Saariaho's L'Amour de Loin, and many others, which seem like classics. I return to them again and again and keep finding new things in them. But I just don't know. And, you know, so all I can do as a critic is to report honestly what I feel, and perhaps others will catch on and agree, and perhaps not. The repertoire is always changing, and some composers are always sort of coming into style and sort of going slightly out of style, and it's always evolving, and I think that's good. I think the repertory should not be fixed. I mean, there are certain composers we're going to keep coming back to again and again, but there's no reason why it should be the same 50 pieces as Virgil Thompson once complained. Okay, there's someone right behind you there in the... Okay.
I was wondering what distinction you make as between Passacaglia and Chacon as far as a repeating bass and a repeating melody, or do you believe there's a distinction to be made? Are those interchangeable as far as history of how composers use them throughout history?
Yeah, that's a real hornet's nest, which I might shy away from getting too deep into off the top of my head. They were interchangeable to some extent early on. I mean, I think the early forms of these dances look very similar, and then the traditions started to diverge a little bit, and people, for example, came to think of the Passacaglia being generally in a minor key and Chacona in the major, and then the Passacaglia perhaps having a more pronounced bass line, but there are many counterexamples. The Chacona in D minor by Bach, for example. It seemed to be sort of always evolving a little bit, and I think the modern definitions of these forms were shaped by the most famous examples as they emerged in the repertory. And it is so fascinating to see how they returned in 20th century music, and they were such deadly serious forms of expression for the likes of Webern, Schoenberg, Berg, Britten, Shostakovich, Ligeti, Hindemith, Karl Orff, many others. But I think Ligeti is especially interesting because he did reconnect sometimes with the original dance-like character of the Chacona, at least, and it would be interesting to see if that could somehow be revived in contemporary music. And I should mention the wonderful recording that I played at the beginning is Jordi Savall and Hesperian 21 of Un Sorau de la Chacona by Juan Arañez. So one more back here.
First of all, I would like to thank you for a brilliant presentation. Secondly, I was wondering where you thought the Portuguese fado came into. I mean, to me, I've heard it many, many times there, and it is the supreme, almost, I don't know, to me, it was just amazingly full of lament.
Yeah, absolutely. I could have talked about fado and also bossa nova. And actually, especially bossa nova, you hear these slinky chromatic patterns all over the place. And I think that may also have had something to do with why in the 1960s, pop musicians were suddenly attracted again to this kind of figure. But the fado, which I don't know so well, but I've certainly heard some amazing examples of, is a great modern example of a kind of lament, which is also a celebration of life. And actually, I was just reading Nietzsche. Doesn't sound pretentious, but Nietzsche in The Birth of Tragedy says that every Greek lament was also a expression of a celebration of a life which had been cut short. He said it better than that. But I think that is very, very important to these examples. And I think it's a mistake to think of, say, Bach's Chacona as a taming of the original dance. It's very different, but it certainly still has the lifeblood in it, and it is deeply emotional music, savage at times, and every bit as alive in its very different way as the original. So I think that's about all we have time for, but...
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.